Welcome back, everybody, to the Brexit podcast for another weekly news roundup. Today, joining me as returning guest, it's Mr. Ollie Dugmore from the student online newspaper, The Tab. Welcome back to the show, Ollie.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for coming back. Since last time, there's been a general election. There's been a massive turnout for the youth vote. This is really your area, so you should be celebrating or even claiming that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's an exercise in vanity, but certainly have been claiming that result entirely as my own responsibility. It's great. I mean, on a personal level, I'm just really happy to see, obviously the figures haven't been finally confirmed and we'll probably get those in autumn, but to see around about a 55 to 56% youth turnout in the general election is amazing. And those would be the highest numbers since 1997, I believe. So yeah, really happy with that.
Okay, well, so let's stomp over old ground too much, but if... giving you at the coalface for that, if there is one reason why you think the youth turned out, you've only got one, what would it be?
Jeremy Corbyn, single-handedly.
Ooh, Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes, exactly. The chants that reverberate around nightclubs around the UK, fields in Pilton at Glastonbury, and just generally if you walk down the street and there's a gathering of young people, you're pretty sure to hear that being sung.
Even though he's not a massive fan of the European Union, which message sort of got lost, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I don't know whether you could argue he's played it well or not, but there seems to certainly be a level of ambiguity when you ask a young person what they think Jeremy Corbyn's stance on the EU is. Not everyone's fully aware of the fact that he sort of, as is the tradition in the long history of British leftist politicians like Tony Benn, for example, actually pretty much despises the entire institution. I don't know whether you could argue that Labour have played a blinder by misleading everyone about that, or that's just a case of misinformation. But certainly, you know, his views on the EU aren't going to turn people off from what they view as someone who's genuine and believes in their own principles. And perhaps, even though he is anti-EU, they respect his dislike of it probably more so than someone like Michael Gove or Boris Johnson, who pretty much is typecast as, you know, espousing that view for their own political game.
Okay. Now, we probably should point out that he did actually lose the general election as well.
Yes, so that's a key point as well, you know, falling somewhat 50 seats behind the Conservative Party or thereabout. Yeah, he definitely lost.
So speaking of the Conservative Party, I'm sure they're going to feature prominently in our news roundup. We've got you on to talk about some debating points from the last week, bring us up to date with all the latest Brexit news. So kick us off with your first point, please.
Absolutely. The first of which is essentially the introduction of ID cards for EU nationals living in the UK. These plans were announced as part of the British government's provisions last week for EU nationals living here. Essentially what's going to happen is that all EU nationals with 5 years of continuous residence inside the UK are going to be invited to apply for what's been called settled status, which is essentially the right to reside in the UK, undertake any lawful activity, so, you know, starting a business, I'm trying to think of other lawful activities, none spring to my mind at this time, but, you know, get access to public funds and apply for citizenship. What that also comes along with is what they're calling a biometric residence document, which essentially boils down to an ID card where the fingerprints of any EU national are going to be taken and then sort of recorded. And if you do not take this document, if you don't accept it, then it's not even an inference, it's actually just a clear statement of fact, you will not be granted the right to stay in the UK.
So what about a passport then? Does that not count?
You would think that. I'm not entirely sure on the sort of necessity of biometric passports across the EU. I don't know whether they're optional in some states or whether they are compulsory, but you would think that would sort of fit the bill. Ironically, David Davis, who is obviously, as we all know, the Brexit Secretary, actually resigned as the shadow Home Secretary over the issue of ID cards. It would appear that he's sort of anti-ID cards unless they're for EU nationals at this point in time. On a personal level, I don't like it at all. I think it would appear to highlight sort of a disparity between what the EU is offering to UK nationals who are living in the EU and what the UK is offering to EU nationals in the UK, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. This is a proposal at this stage, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. You know, it is by no means sort of set in stone at all. It's very much part of, it came out as part of a document for the sort of discussing the government's stance, and then this is all going to be negotiated and bartered around on. It's essentially, there are 3.2 million EU nationals living in the UK, and there are about 1 million UK nationals living in the EU. It's a massive issue for both sides to hash out. And the EU has been clear so far, at least on their position, which is essentially that the sort of the offer from the UK to their nationals living there basically has to be fairly similar to what they're offering to UK nationals. And that is essentially, in their eyes, you know, the rights of anyone who's living in the UK at the moment to be continued, and that any sort of, you know, document of this nature, or ID card as we've been calling it, has to be voluntary, and you can't enforce it on EU citizens living in the UK.
Yeah, oh, I know ID cards in this country have a history of being pretty much despised from Thatcher and football, and it was linked to hooliganism, and it linked to data protection, and linked to invasiveness and all of these things. So we'll watch this space to see if that one's going to fly. Michel Barnier, the EU chief negotiator, tweeted last week that the current British negotiation plans lacks ambition, clarity and guarantees. So I guess he'd probably hold firm on that position in this case. Let's move it on to point two.
Happily. So the second point that I've come to talk about is Günther Oettinger, who's the European Commissioner for the Budget. He has stated that Britain's withdrawal could leave a 20 billion euro sized hole in the EU budget. For a sense of scale, the EU budget in 2017 was 157.9 billion euros. So that's, you know, an eighth, roughly, of the entire EU budget that he's saying that we could be leaving behind. Really, a couple of really interesting talking points here. The first is that obviously the UK is a net payer into the European Union. So even with the Thatcher rebate, which is around 3 billion euros, something that Margaret Thatcher negotiated back when, as we all know, the European Union has always been a thorn in the side of the Conservative Party, and it's sort of, you could potentially make the argument, it's brought down every Conservative Prime Minister since we joined. But she essentially negotiated a rebate. Even with that, you know, we're still around about making a 10 billion euro-sized contribution or so. The first thing I'd sort of draw out from this is that it's very clear to me that the UK stands to make financial gain from departing the EU. Maybe we could spend some of it on the NHS, as was advertised on the side of a rather famous bus during the campaign. But also that Britain actually has some really significant cards to hold in its hand during negotiations. That is a colossal amount of money, and whilst only 10 billion of it is literal euros, and the other half essentially comes from what Mr. Oettinger described as essentially sort of security and defence costs. So not literal costs, but, well, literal costs in the sense, you know, there's a lot of intelligence sharing going on between European police forces, but also you have to talk about soft power and the impact that Britain's departure is going to have on that. So, for example, Britain is a nuclear power. We're one of very few nations who fulfil our NATO 2% defence spending requirement. We have the fifth largest defence budget in the world. We're also a permanent member of the UN Security Council, and we have troops stationed in the Baltics, in Estonia and Poland, which, you know, is really significant if we're talking about you know, Russian expansion that we've seen over the last sort of 5 years. All of those things. Well, admittedly, the troops actually and the intelligence sharing are a specific cost. But Mr. Oettinger wrote in a blog later in the week, essentially, that 10 billion net contribution that we make is effectively doubled when you account for all of those other things that, when we leave, the EU is either going to have to seek to fill and sort of make up for that void, or re-strategise. And either of those two options is going to cost money.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There's quite heavy hitters in Europe, aren't we, at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, you could legitimately, you know, make that point. I think it's very easy to get down about, you know, our negotiating position and sort of we're having this. I read over the weekend that the latest figure on the divorce bill was going to be £87 billion. And I first of all, that's just beggar's belief. I don't think that's going to be the case. But also, you know, we are a really major part of the EU, and our negotiating position is not necessarily one of strength, but it's certainly nowhere near as weak as people are making out to be. The second thing I just would quickly touch on as well with that is that after Britain leaves, that the Thatcher rebate, that when that was negotiated, was also given to Germany, Austria, the Netherlands and Sweden. The EU is saying that when we leave, their rebates are also going to be reanalyzed and probably removed by 2020.
Yeah, try and get a little bit of that back.
Mm.
So unsettling for some of those countries as well.
Yeah, no doubt. And obviously as well, the most literal consequence that you could think of the Brexit vote would be other sort of anti-countries with a significant anti-EU sentiment would be looking perhaps at their own departure from the Union. Whereas in actual fact, what we're looking at is, you know, sort of the legislative institutional impact also that also exists for other countries. And this is just one of many that other nations are going to be subject to.
Okay, well, thanks. I think you explained that brilliantly. Let's move on to point three, Ollie.
Sure. And that point would be the vice chair of the EU Environmental Committee, Yavor Benedek. I'm sorry, Yavor, if I've pronounced your name wrong. And he has basically come out and said that the UK risks becoming the dirty man of Europe. That's a direct quote this week. He has essentially he's touched on a couple of things. The first of which is that the EU is re-strategizing to what they're calling a circular economy, which is basically a sort of a total strategy hoping to make companies be accountable for sort of the production of goods, but then also their waste management afterwards. And obviously with the UK leaving, we're therefore not going to be included in that strategy and as a result, therefore risk becoming a dumping ground for plastic waste. A global figure, 1 million plastic bottles are bought every minute in the world, which is a staggering number. And a colossal amount of that washes up on the UK beaches. When I was at Glasto last week, the pyramid stage, there's a screen next to it. It showed a video documenting an expedition by the Beluga 2, which is a research vessel commissioned by Greenpeace. I was a little worse for wear, but I think one of the screens said what the figure was 16 million bottles wash up on UK shores every week. Now, that sounds a huge number to me. And I want to say as well, I tried to verify that figure before coming in here and I couldn't find any information on their website that corroborated that. So take that with a pinch of salt. But either way, I'm sure that there's a lot of plastic washing up on our beaches. You can watch video footage from them. And, you know, the UK, let's have a look at this figure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8. Yeah, we're 8th down. On meeting the EU target of 50% recycled household waste. The one thing to note on that as well, though, I would say is, I'm pulling this figure off the top of my head, but I think early 2000s, UK total plastic waste recycling was at around 13,000 tonnes. In 2014, I believe, it was more than 300,000 tonnes. So the flip side is, you know, the UK is certainly making really significant inroads on the amount of plastic recycling that we're doing. But what this is basically highlighting, and the EU is highlighting, is that by not being a part of this strategy, it's entirely possible that we could become essentially, you know, the site of illegal, or in fact legal, depending on, you know, UK legislation, the dumping site for a lot of plastic waste.
We could also, given that we are an island and we have these beautiful beaches, and these beautiful beaches are a huge tourist attraction, and we really want to protect them, that we could go one step further and actually have a better policy. So this could work both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the flip side of this, there was a Lib Dem MEP, I believe, Catherine Bearder, and she was basically saying that the UK lacks the political will to go the other way, which I would disagree with. You know, the three largest security threats that are widely acknowledged by any sort of security firm or consultancy are international terrorism, cybercrime, and climate change.
And not Donald Trump.
No, he's sort of perceived as an ally at this stage, although obviously that remains to be seen. There's a distinction here. So political will in Parliament and political will of the British people. Now, obviously, my concept of that is fairly heavily skewed. Being a part of the TAB, I spend a lot of my time around students and student journalists. So, you know, obviously, I appreciate the people I'm speaking to on a daily basis aren't representative of the wider British population. But the environment is a huge issue for those guys, and there is absolutely, you know, political will amongst those people to see sort of the UK's stance on environmental issues change. The flip side of that is that the Conservative Party is in coalition with the DUP. The DUP have, in the past, appointed to Environment Minister, to the Environment Minister post in Northern Ireland, a climate denier and also a significant member of their senior leadership team are creationists. So there is that to bear in mind. But, you know, the flip side, as I said, is that I think widely the British public are very environmentally aware. And as you mentioned, you know, who wants to see plastic bottles washing up on the British coastline that is a massive part of our cultural and historical heritage?
Yeah, I think the will of the people ultimately should will out on that one, shouldn't it? Because they'll, you know, we as we recycle more, as the greener we get, you know, we buy products that are greener, potentially. I don't know. I guess we'll see. It's interesting, though. So currently we stand at, or the 2015 figures on recycled household waste, we're at 43%, something like that. And the target is 50% by 2020. Germany, Austria, Slovenia, Belgium are already at that target.
Fair play to them. And, you know, I think that's... I would like to see a historical, you know, growth chart of that, because I think you could look 10 years ago and I imagine those figures would probably be less than 20 or, you know, maybe even 10%.
Sure.
But, you know, still room to go.
Let's move on to our next point.
Happily. So this is a little bit of a nib, I will be perfectly honest. However...
That's the news in brief for anyone who's of the non-journalistic
persuasion. Sorry. Apologies, yeah. So relating to two of the most prestigious, actually, European agencies located in London in Canary Wharf, the European Medicines Agency and the European Banking Authority. They're part of the bureaucracy of the European Union, and what comes with bureaucracy is bureaucrats, roughly 1,000 of them. All highly skilled, therefore highly paid staff, you know, significant contributors to research and also the UK economy by bringing their higher wages and all the rest of it and spending them here. What's interesting about this for me is that the relocation of these agencies was essentially denied by David Davis. So even the EU was about to run a competition to relocate them. A spokesperson for the Brexit department said, "No decisions have been taken. They will be the subject of exit negotiations." Last week, it took 4 minutes for the EU27, the remaining member states, to decide the terms of the competition for which the two agencies would be bartered off. This point is really, really important for me because it distinguishes sort of the difference between the reality of the situation and the sort of narrative that is trying to be established by sort of the... by any political figure in the UK. I think it's really, really important that when there's an instance of this where, you know, a department is trying to say one thing and the reality of the situation is pretty starkly different, that we do highlight it. And you mentioned Donald Trump. It's actually, I think it's pretty decidedly Trumpian to sort of, I think it's quite misleading to talk about this change in those terms, in the terms that David Davis did, that essentially the relocation of these agencies was no way set in stone and that they were going to be part of negotiations. Well, when you consider it, it's, I would say, perplexing or confusing to think that two really, really significant EU institutions would still find their headquarters in London once we departed the European Union. And the reality has then played out to reflect that.
Yeah, and that's quite a fair point. The whole thing about negotiations and negotiation strategy and that you play as much hardball as possible, because when that's then all done, you get a slice of the cake. I don't know if that really works, because I think there's definitely a fact that you come up with these outright, you come up with these sorts of lines, you're danger of putting people offside immediately in the opposition, so they will immediately become I know people are distrustful anyway, but they will become even more distrustful with if you start making what could be argued to be an outlandish claim.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not winning friends and influencing people.
Certainly not. You know, you do end up in this sort of who's going to blink first situation where, you know, let's just take this as an example. David Davis says, you know, this isn't up for discussion, well, or will be, come to negotiations, but, you know, there's no way they're leaving at this stage. And then the EU go, oh, my God, David Davis has said that we're not going to relocate these agencies. How are we going to respond to this in negotiation? Well, I guess we start talking about how we're going to relocate them. And it's sort of this race to the top, whereas in actual fact, I would argue there are things that we can be playing hardball over. For example, the things we spoke about earlier, security and defence, massive things that the UK is probably one of the largest contributors towards. That I would say that's an area where we'd be better off playing hardball rather than something as EU as bureaucracy, where I think they're always going to win over, you know, relocating an agency or whatever.
Although, I mean, even just to argue the case slightly on security and defence, it feels like maybe it's too an important in point to use.
Oh, yeah, I mean, obviously, 100%, you know, that's a... It's a difficult conversation to have, and if you're talking about withdrawing troops from, as the ones I mentioned, Estonia in particular, you know, that's like realpolitik, you know, that's pretty Machiavellian to pull that as a point. But nothing's off the table. You have to have frank conversations, and at the same time, you know, ID cards. For me personally, that's a really significant point relating to civil liberties and, you know, the rights of citizens. But, you know, we're talking about fingerprinting 3.2 million EU nationals to allow them to stay in the UK. All of these issues, you know, they are tetchy, they are important, and obviously talking about them in the wrong terms can lead to a massive upset or embarrassment, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be talking about them.
No, absolutely. And just a slightly off tack, but not entirely, when we mentioned there about the European Medicines Agency and also the European Banking Authority, I do realise there are a lot of European bodies out there that people may not be aware of exactly what each one does, and it does get hellishly confusing at times. So last week, we had the lovely Olivia Gavoyanis in doing some work experience with us, and what she's very kindly done is pulled together a glossary of useful terms for the website. So if anybody is at all confused about anything Brexit related, from Article 50 to the ECJ to the EEA to the EFTA to the EU Chamber of Fundamental Rights, etc., 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 just nip along to brexitpodcast.com, and our latest blog post from Olivia spells it all out for you.
That is a masterful segue.
That's sort of my first ad break. That's what it felt like. Should we pay ourselves for the ad on that one? Right, let's move it on. Have we got another point, or are we nearly there?
Yeah, we've got a couple more points, actually. Great. So this weekend was sort of the first of many situations, I think, where we're going to see the Cabinet gradually ramping up the pressure on Theresa May. The first of which was Michael Gove on Andrew Marr yesterday, so that was Sunday. He basically went on, talked about a lot of stuff, mounted a defence for tuition fees, amongst other things. But one of the key things he said in relation, well, I'm going to draw Brexit out of this, but he essentially said that the government should be listening to independent bodies that review public sector pay and then accepting their findings. So at the moment, as I'm sure most people know, there's a 1% cap across all public sector wage increases, which often at times is below inflation. So in real terms, public sector workers are actually receiving a pay cut. What that does, obviously, is puts a lot of stress on public sector workers. But at the moment, Mr. Gove says, it's also putting a lot of stress on government. And there's sort of a collective view amongst the cabinet that the government has to listen to the independent findings of these bodies and basically increase that 1% cap. There have also been reports this weekend that Jeremy Hunt intends to demand a wage boost for NHS workers as well. All of this, you might be asking, well, what has this got to do with Brexit? The government at the moment has a majority of two in the House of Commons after the DUP coalition. So what that means is they are essentially at the mercy of, well, everyone, if I'm perfectly honest. You know, this is just the start. So members of the cabinet, backbenchers, even the 27 intake, Kemi Badenoch, Ben Bradley, people like that, you know, it only takes one or two people to you know, withhold their vote on, you know, a certain issue or a certain amendment that they want made to a bill, and the government's looking at not being able to pass it through the House of Commons. So we're seeing the cabinet increase pressure on the government now relating to public sector pay. It's only going to be a matter of time once we're into the meat of the negotiations that every single point you could foresee, a member of the cabinet, a member of the backbench, a new 27 intake MP essentially saying, you know what, I won't vote for this. I want this amendment to be made. I want so-and-so to be tabled. I'd like you to resolve this. I want you to fix that. All of these, every single opportunity, essentially, where there's going to be something going through the House of Commons, there is a majority of two. So this is the first of many, many, I think, long weekends that we're going to see Theresa May basically being, I don't want to say sort of put into a legislative straitjacket, but she is very much going to be, have her hands tied by her cabinet, and, you know, on any point, whether that's from Liam Fox, David Davis, you know, two traditionally pretty hardline Eurosceptic guys, and then you sort of look at them all like Notting Hill set commentary at Michael Gove back in the cabinet now as environment minister. wanting a soft Brexit, there's that. There's a real friction and a real tension between those personalities inside the cabinet, both of whom are going to be trying to exert their influence over whatever the negotiations look like, both obviously within their own handling of them, but certainly on cabinet decisions and then acts going through the House of Commons.
So May is in a legislative straitjacket with the hands tied behind the back all the way into another general election.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty fair, probably in about 6 months' time.
Exciting times.
Exciting times, perhaps worrying times as well, though.
Yeah. Good point. Well made.
Thanks very much. Speaking of Michael Gove, my final point is relating to something else he also said this morning on the Andrew Marr Show and also in an interview with Tim Shipman in the Times, and that is that the UK is taking back control of its fishing waters. You might remember that phrase from around about a year ago during a certain campaign. Today the government is going to trigger withdrawal from the London Fisheries Convention, signed in 1964, and that allows the UK, France, Belgium, Germany, Ireland and the Netherlands to fish between 6 and 12 nautical miles of each other's coastlines. You might think that's a bizarrely specific sort of parameter to set, but
Unenforceable, perhaps.
Yeah, potentially you would think so. But the reason why it's that range is because the common fishing policy that the EU has then allows fishing from 12 to 200 nautical miles. So it's essentially, it allows this sort of set, group of nations, the sort of pretty much Benelux, to go, you know, an extra 6 nautical miles towards each other's coastlines in their fishing.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure what the significance of those 6 nautical miles is. I don't know enough about the commercial fishing industry, but I'm sure maybe there's richer waters there or whatever. The reason why I wanted to talk about this is because, for several reasons actually, fishing kind of has this colossal symbolism now attached to it. Whenever we talk about the European Union, there's a reason why Nigel Farage rowed a flotilla of fishermen down the Thames on sort of as we approached polling day. And the reason for that is that it, at least in my eyes, which is a pretty boring legislative one, but it all stems from the Faxitame case, which essentially established in the UK the primacy of EU law. It was the judicial ruling that basically said EU law takes precedence over UK law. So if there's an EU ruling that runs contrary to anything UK law says, the EU law is the one which the courts will adhere to. So it basically came from a case where a Spanish company was suing the UK government because the UK said that to have a ship registered in Britain, it had to have majority British owners, which obviously is a difficulty for, you know, let's say a Spanish fishing company.
Of course.
So this essentially, I mean, it's going to be triggered. And as I said, you know, the impact on fishing, I don't really know too much about, but I can talk about the symbolism of this event. It's really, really significant, not just for the fishing industry, but also for Brexit voters, Nigel Farage and Michael Gove, who during the campaign said that his father's fishing business was closed due to the EU.
I heard estimations that it might bring in about £70 million for British fishermen. I guess that's not a colossal amount, but so the symbolism is the important thing. We had Alan Hastings on in episode 73 talking. He's from Fishing for Leave, the pressure group, and he was talking about this whole issue and about claiming back UK waters. I do have some sympathy, I think, for the position here.
Absolutely.
You know, the insanity of almost from fishing boats coming from other nations, coming close to UK waters, catching fish, going back home and then selling them back into a UK market would seem something of a nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, if people were coming from abroad or Brits were going onto the continent to farm a Frenchman's field, it would just seem bizarre. I don't know whether you can make the same case for waters.
But I think you absolutely can. You know, at the end of the day, the territory we're talking about is as sovereign as the physical land. You know, the medium is just different. Particularly when we're talking about sort of the fishing practices. I know, as I said, I'm by no means an expert, but if you're talking about, first of all, dredging and trawling, which can be hugely damaging for coastlines and sort of natural marine wildlife.
Yeah, you just scoop up pretty much everything.
Exactly.
Right? Take what you want and discard.
Exactly. And then the flip side, it's just the same thing with the common fisheries policy, is that because of quotas, essentially but there's a colossal amount of bycatch. You know, so if you're looking to, don't know what sort of fish you might be catching and then keeping, but let's say you're targeting one species, let's say it's tuna, and anything else you catch is, it dies and they cast it back into the ocean. You know, that's hugely damaging. And in my eyes, to not be part of that and to be able to legislate sensibly and to mitigate against those things seems like a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah. Just, you mentioned tuna there, and it did bring up something, and people should go online to look up the full details for this, but we talked earlier about pollution in the seas, and there's some worrying statistics actually about tuna. I don't want to put anybody off particularly eating it, but tuna live to a ripe old age, and the amount of pollution that they ingest over the years, and which sends their mercury levels through the roof, is quite an interesting area to have a look at. Not that I want to destroy John West's tuna business in any of this.
Bring him down.
Yes, but I don't know. I think it certainly should make you think before chucking more plastic bottles on the beach. Ollie, thank you ever so much for joining us today. It's been terrific as always. Thanks for doing all your research for last week. I think things continue to get more and more interesting and in some ways more and more complex over Brexit. So it's good to try and bring as much clarity as possible.
I'll try my best. Thanks very much for having me, Tim. I appreciate it.
And join us on Thursday for the next episode. The Brexit Podcast is a Tim Hemming, Jen Hahn and Warren Pohl production, with the theme music by Kim.